Welcome to A Fork in Time, the alternate history podcast.
Welcome to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. I'm Don Shelley, your host. Once again, pleased that you are taking a little bit of your time, which is one of the most precious resources that you have, to give us today to listen to the podcast. I'm actually very excited about today's podcast, the episode today, because it represents some new things in the early part of A Fork in Time. One of the things that it represents is one of the first times that we've actually had on a listener as a guest host. Now, we've had other folks on as guest hosts. For those of you that have listened to other episodes of the podcast, you'll know that I think some of our best episodes have been with our guest hosts. But what's different about our guest host today is I didn't know Brant Frost before launching off into this endeavor called A Fork in Time, and him finding us and then interacting with our website and sending some suggestions on and some commentaries about episodes and then becoming a Patreon supporter. So Brant marks a first here in A Fork in Time history, and that's a listener who's now come on to be a host. I hope he's the first of many that will follow, so I'm excited about sort of breaking new ground on the podcast today with Brant joining us. So, Brant, I appreciate you joining us. I'd like you to start by giving folks a little background on who you are and maybe a little bit of how you found the podcast and what some of your likes and interests are. That way people can feel like they're getting to know you a little bit.
Well, thank you very much. It's great to be here, and I very much enjoy the opportunity. I've been a fan of science fiction, alternative history for many, many years, read dozens of books about it. I'm a great fan of history in general. I love just about any era of history, and particularly American political history. And this particular election, the 1940 election, is one of the most crucial in American history. And it's amazing some of the great historical events that were intertwining here and some of the great characters of the 20th century. If you were to write a book about this, as many have, and I've read several of them, it's truly a very gripping and dynamic tale. You have Roosevelt, Churchill involved in this. Of course, the British were very interested. You had Stalin, Hitler, Mussolini, some of the, and of course, the most, I think the most interesting character in this story is Wendell Willkie, a man who went from being a registered Democrat and a corporate CEO to coming within a hair's breadth becoming president of the United States. And his story is really amazing.
Yeah, I agree with you there. A tremendous. The number of person, you know, history is full of personalities. And a lot of times when we go back far enough in history, we don't get a sense of knowing the personalities as well because we don't have, you know, moving pictures of them. We don't have audio of them. So we have to imagine them by how they're described or, you know, or still photos or paintings or that type of thing. And so one of the unique things about the early part of the 20th century is we begin to have these ways of accessing these personas, you know, that's independent of just what people have written about them. But at the same point, as you well point out, this is a tremendously powerful moment in not just modern history, but just history in general. And to have all of these personas that are there being part of that makes it even more dynamic. And how much of what we know of history now, the real timeline, is a result of them, or how much is a result of the forces that shaped them, and sort of understanding the two things between them, I think, is an interesting point of view. As Brant's already mentioned here, we're going to be exploring today on the podcast the 1940 election. And as you know, what we do on A Fork in Time is we look at that alternative history, the fork, taking the other path in history. And so the way that we've chosen to fork the episode today around the 1940 election is under the assumption that there is already in presence the 22nd Amendment. And for those who are not Americans who may be listeners, I know we have some international listeners as well, or for those that just need a refresher, Brant, what does the 22nd Amendment do in terms of allowing who and who cannot run for president?
Well, that's a very good question. And this is going to be very interesting because this is 1940 we're discussing. But the point of divergence is 1789, because in 1788, when the Virginia Ratifying Convention was deciding whether or not to ratify the federal constitution proposed in Philadelphia, they proposed around 20 amendments, many of whom would become part of the Bill of Rights. But one of the amendments they proposed would not become part of the Bill of Rights. And that was a proposed amendment that would have stated, no person shall be capable of being president of the United States for more than 8 years in any term of 16 years. In other words, you could be president for 8 consecutive years, but then you'd have to take 4 years off and then before you could have another bite at the apple. So it's a little different than the 22nd Amendment, which allows for a president to serve, to be elected only twice in their lifetime. But it does allow them to serve up to 2 years of their predecessor's term if they are a vice president and succeed at the office. So in 1789, when the Congress was debating what would become the Bill of Rights, they took many of the Virginia ratifying convention suggestions. Our proposed point of divergence will be that Congress takes, in addition to the others, this term limit amendment. Many people thought that the presidency would be in good hands and they didn't have to worry so much about abuse because George Washington would be the first president. Right. When you think about it in the context of history, however, that is very short-sighted because obviously Washington is only one man and after he goes, someone else will be president. So I would imagine this article being adopted as written in Virginia, but with a caveat saying that it shall not apply to the president at the time of its adoption.
Which would have meant Washington.
Precisely. Yeah. And which would also keep in the be in context to the attitude that Washington is the indispensable man, but the man who comes after him is not so indispensable.
Right.
And as a result, history pretty much remains the same. The only significant difference would possibly be in 1920 when Woodrow Wilson, who secretly wanted a third term, conspired behind the scenes to harm the presidential prospects of both his Secretary of the Treasury, William Gibbs McAdoo, and his Attorney General, A. Mitchell Palmer. And had that not been the case, possibly McAdoo or Palmer would have been the nominee for president in 1920 over James Middleton Cox. However, either one would have gone down to defeat to Warren G. Harding. The tide of 1920 was too strong against the Democrats. But right. Other than that, history would not be changed that much. However, just one other thing, hypothetically speaking, if this amendment had been in place in 1963, Lyndon Johnson would not have been able to run for president in 1968, which would have dramatically altered the shape of the 1968 election without Johnson as a looming presence in that race. But that's a different point.
Yeah, so, and perhaps an episode we'll explore later, because again, even though Johnson did not run in 68, he had the ability to run and made the decision fairly late in the process to the famous, I will neither seek nor accept language.
Right.
You know,
so we have our point of divergence, and it's one of those nice ones that has virtually no butterfly effect until we get to 1940.
Right.
Bringing us, you can tell from my use of the lingo that I've read a great deal of alternative history. And so then we come up to two big questions. The first is obviously, who will the Democrats nominate, if not Roosevelt? And then another corollary to that is, does the Republican primary change? Because without Roosevelt as a popular and heavyweight Democrat candidate, do the Republicans nominate someone else besides Wilkie? I'm going to argue, for the purpose of this discussion, the question is not only what if Roosevelt didn't run and was barred from running, but what would a Wilkie presidency look like? I'm going to assume Wilkie still gets the nomination. I think he probably would have, but he would have had a tougher race of it. And I'm going to assume a different vice president. I'm going to assume that the convention deadlocked after 8 or 10 ballots, and Wilkie had to make a deal with somebody, and the first guy who he was able to make a deal with was Arthur James, the very popular governor of Pennsylvania. And the reason Pennsylvania is so important is because if you look at a list of states that Roosevelt won in the real election, Pennsylvania was the tipping point state. In other words, if you take all the states that Roosevelt won by narrow margins and with the narrowest margin first and started adding them to the Wilkie column, Wilkie crosses the 50% threshold in the Electoral College when he carries Pennsylvania.
Right.
So you have a Wilkie James ticket versus the Democrat Party. And now the question is, who are the Democrat candidates? There were 5 main contenders in 1940 based on Gallup polling done in the 2 years leading up to the convention. There was John Nance Garner, Cordell Hull, James Farley, Paul McNutt, and Senator Burton K. Wheeler. And, of course, Garner was the main candidate in the polls going into 1940. Most people thought that the 1940 election would be fought between Garner as the Democrat nominee and Thomas Dewey as the Republican nominee. Both of them were leading in the polls. But what we saw, just like with Wilkie having a late surge, Cordell Hull had a late surge in the polls in the real timeline. What would happen was Gallup would poll in the Democratic race, Roosevelt and without Roosevelt. In other words, they'd ask voters, who do you favor, Democrat voters, who do you favor for president? When Roosevelt was included, he had 70%+. Without Roosevelt considered, it was a real mishmash. But what we saw was, up until the spring of 1940, Garner was the heavy favorite. And then there's a significant shift. And by the time you get to convention, he is now dropped to about 12%. And Cordell Hull is up in the 20s.
Yeah, and one of the things that jumps out at me there, I know you shared that polling data. It's amazing. My background, as you can tell, Brent, is very well read and very, very much a student of American political history, particularly presidential elections, but American political history in general, is that, as we now live in these what seems like interminable, never-ending 4-year election cycles for the presidency. It literally begins almost the day after the previous election. To be talking about, March and April of the actual year of the general election, still being somewhat early, or just the timing differential there is one of the things that immediately jumps out to me. And I just want to mention that because a lot of our listeners may think, why weren't they talking about this in November of the year before? When we start, for example, we're having debates now in the United States for the 2020 election, and we're not even out of 2019 yet. It was a very different timeline that existed back then in terms of how fast things moved during the actual election year itself.
Oh, yes. And that was mainly due to the fact that the political party conventions actually picked the nominee rather than the primaries. The primaries were, most of the time, the primaries were not even binding on delegates in terms of pledges. Only about a dozen to 15 states did primaries. New Hampshire, Massachusetts, Pennsylvania, New Jersey, Indiana, Ohio, Illinois, Wisconsin, Nebraska, South Dakota, Oregon, California. No southern states other than Maryland and West Virginia conducted primaries in those days. And it was pretty much those states consistently. But the rest of the nation, including big states like New York, did not have primaries, or Texas.
Right.
But when you get to the convention, what you see two names I didn't get a chance to talk about. Jim Farley was basically the Karl Rove / David Axelrod / James Carville of the Democrat Party. I mean, he was the man, the ultimate political guru. He remembered everyone's name. He had helped mastermind FDR's ascent to the White House in 1932. He was appointed DNC chairman and served from 1932 until 1940. He was also appointed Postmaster General, because in those days, Postmaster General hired the most government jobs in the whole federal government. Talk about how small government was back then. The Post Office Department had the most jobs, and they would be given out to loyal Democrats or loyal Republicans, depending on which party was in the White House. So that was the chief patronage job. Right. So he was Postmaster General, but he wanted to be president himself in 1940. And with Roosevelt not able to run, Farley would definitely be in the mix. And you also have to remember that without Roosevelt sort of forcing the agenda, you have a much more contentious battle between the interventionists and the non-interventionists in the Democrat Party. And that's where Senator Burton K. Wheeler from Montana comes in. He was a progressive, a populist, a contrarian. He had bolted from the Democrats in 1924 to run on the Progressive Party ticket as vice president with Senator Robert LaFollette, former Republican from Wisconsin. So Wheeler was the most outspoken and well-known non-interventionist in the Democrat Party in 1940. And although he was old, and relatively older, Cordell Hull was 69. So,
Let's explore those terms a little bit too, just so for our listeners who may not be as familiar with it. We tend to think of the 1940s, very quickly. The first thing that immediately pops into my mind is World War II, which is going to begin, has already begun by the time we're here to the 1940 American presidential election. It's just not something that the United States is formally involved in at this point. And so when you talk about interventionist and non-interventionist, sometimes we talk about the term isolationist, sometimes used to describe American foreign policy in much of the 1930s. Unwind that a little bit for our listeners, Brent, in terms of why that's important because of the backdrop of the 1940 election, which is Europe is at war, Asia is at war, but the United States is not yet formally engaged in either of those wars. They are supplying support through the Lend-Lease program to Britain, but we are standing alone. We are outside of the conflict that's already brewing in two major parts of the world.
Yes. And to my knowledge, no opponent of intervention in World War II ever called themselves isolationist. It was an abusive term that their opponents used against them. The term interventionist was typically used, but was also used by the non-interventionist as a form of attack on the interventionist. The interventionists referred to themselves by various terms, but the term isolation. Is probably best used to describe the United Kingdom in the 19th century. Lord Salisbury, who was Prime Minister of Britain during the 1880s and the 1890s, described the splendid isolation that Britain enjoyed thanks to the English Channel, right, where they could stand aloof from European wars and conflicts and be able to choose which side to stand with, based on their own interests and have that flexibility. And of course, that applied even more so to the United States being separated not just by a channel, but by a whole ocean from Europe.
The Atlantic is an awful big English channel under that analogy.
The Atlantic is the largest moat in the world, second only to the Pacific Ocean. Right. And what you had in 1940 were America First Committee, which was formed. And it brought together a very wide coalition, a bipartisan coalition of people with varying different views. They all agreed that they didn't want the United States to join the war, but they didn't necessarily agree why they wanted to. For example, you had communists who opposed intervention into the war because Stalin had signed a pact with Hitler. On the other hand, you had breakaway communists who were in favor of war because they couldn't stand the obvious hypocrisy where Stalin had in 1939 said, The fascists must be defeated. And then he signs a secret pact with Hitler. And all of a sudden, the line out of Moscow is communism and fascism are compatible. But you had some communists, the Communist Party, who was saying not to enter the war because Moscow was directing that. Mm-hmm. You had old style progressives and anti-Wall Street guys like Burton K. Wheeler and Republican Senator Gerald Nye from North Dakota, who looked back at World War One and saw it as an attempt by the big business interests in the East Coast to pull the British Empire's chestnuts out of the fire and to save their investments in British markets. And they said, never again will we send, Midwestern farm boys to save J.P. Morgan and the Rockefellers and the big banks on Wall Street. And right. You notice that many of the same sentiments that are expressed today go all the way back to 1940 and even further than that. Then you had people like Charles A. Lindbergh, who was not political for most of his life. He was still a relatively young man in 1940. He wasn't even 40 years old yet. His father had been a congressman from the state of Minnesota, but he was not particularly political. But his point of view was that the United States ought not to get involved in European wars. We ought to act as a peacemaker in similar to the way Theodore Roosevelt tried to act as peacemaker successfully. He acted as peacemaker between Russia and Japan and the Russo-Japanese War. But this is another part that people forget. Lindbergh insisted, and the America First Committee adopted as a key part of their principles, that they would be dedicated to the rearming of the United States. You would get the idea, and certainly since the interventionists write the history books, that the anti-interventionists were against rearmament. They were not. They advocated for rearmament, and they opposed things like Lend-Lease on the grounds that we would be sending weapons, which we didn't have to spare, to countries that probably were going to be defeated anyway.
Right. It wasn't a question of not having a military. Is what were you going to use that military to do or not to do?
Exactly. Basically, they wanted a large military that would be used as a deterrent toward German or Japanese aggression. And you also have to remember that polling at that time, and even within the America First group, polling at that time indicated that very few Americans wanted to engage in war in Europe to save France. A larger number were prepared to join to save England. And virtually everyone agreed that we should join to save Canada. In other words, if Germany had somehow overrun Britain and was then trying to force Canada to give the Germans bases in Canada or something like that, virtually all Americans agreed we should do whatever's necessary to prevent that from happening.
That would have been on our side of the moat, to use your analogy from earlier.
It would have indeed. And that's another interesting factor in this election. So Wilkie is nominated. And for the sake of this example, so that he will become president, we will say that he chooses a better vice president from a more vital swing state of Pennsylvania, Governor Arthur James. And now the Democrats, who are they going to nominate? Cordell Hull was a good friend of Roosevelt's. He had served faithfully as Secretary of State. He'd been chairman of the Democrat Party. He'd been a congressman. He'd been a senator. His only real defect was that he was 69 years old and going into a tough election and a potential world war, that would have been seen as a potential problem. The other problem is that he was from Tennessee. Now, Tennessee is not the Deep South, but there was still a stigma attached towards Southern politicians in those days. You've got to remember that no Southerner won the presidency from 1848 until 1976. The last president from the Deep South to win the presidency was Zachary Taylor in 1848, and the next one was Jimmy Carter in 1976. Right. So that would have been a problem for Hull. Then you have John Nance Garner, who has even more problems being from the South and being more of a conservative Democrat, although he'd been fairly loyal to Roosevelt's program for the first few years of his administration. Then you got Jim Farley, whose biggest defect is that he's never run for office before. He's a big mover and shaker. He's got a lot of friends, but he's never been tested before the voters. And then you have a guy that probably no one listening to us has ever heard of named Paul McNutt. He was a big New Dealer. He was a relatively young man. He's a former governor of Indiana, elected in 1933. He implemented a New Deal in Indiana, New Deal style program. And he was term limited in 36, could run for second term. But he was preparing to run in 1940. A lot of people liked him, saw him as a younger version of FDR. So you throw all these forces together, and then there's some dark horses. Senate Majority Leader Alvin Barkley, who would become vice president under Harry Truman. You have Secretary of the Interior Harold Ickes, a big Roosevelt ally. You have Harry Hopkins, the president's assistant and right-hand man and confidant. There was Secretary of the Agriculture Henry A. Wallace, but being a political neophyte, it's very unlikely anyone would have drawn on him for a candidate, except perhaps as a favorite son from Iowa. And then a big powerful player in Democrat politics, yet someone who virtually no one considers a presidential candidate when they go back looking at that time, New York Governor Herbert Lehman, Lehman Brothers. He'd been lieutenant governor under Roosevelt from 1929 to 1933 when he became governor and was elected in 32, 34, 36, and 38. In the last election, he defeated Thomas Dewey, who, of course, would go on to become governor himself and a presidential candidate. So Lehman being from New York and New York being a key swing state, perhaps the key swing state,
right.
you could see him carrying
47 electoral votes, by the way.
Exactly. You could see him being potentially drafted as a presidential or vice presidential candidate. Of course, Lehman was also Jewish. So this is only 12 years after Al Smith was rejected by many voters for being Catholic. So that would have probably played in the minds of Democrat movers and shakers, because you got to remember, this is not a primary election. This is a convention,
right,
where power brokers have to decide, kind of like a parliament, where competing interests have to form a coalition in order, much like the Israeli parliament's going through this difficulty now, facing a third election in 1 year because the various interests can't get together to form a majority. A national convention is very much like a parliament with 10 different parties. So my personal belief, when you factor all these into consideration, is that the most likely nominee would have been Cordell Hull or a dark horse candidate, more of a second tier candidate like McNutt or Barkley, but probably would not have been Garner or Farley. For the purpose of this example, I would say that Hull gets the nomination after several ballots, but Burton Wheeler is a significant presence, because the anti-war, the anti-interventionist faction will rally behind him. And I see a scenario where Hull gets the nomination and Jim Farley makes a deal to become his vice president. You know, that's a good role for a political mover and shaker, also political attack dog. Farley would have no problem attacking the Republicans, whereas Hull would play the role of senior statesman to guide the nation through troubling times. But with the Democrats dedicated to interventionism and the Republicans even more so under Wilkie, the question is, does the Republican, do renegade Republicans and Democrats break away and run a third party candidate? And I could very easily see Wheeler, who would run as a third party vice president, breaking away and running as a third party candidate, even if he only got a small percentage of the vote. That would be enough to tip the popular vote to Wilkie, because if you look at 1940, there are some key measurements as to whether or not which party was going to win the election. And Alan Lichtman has written a great book called Keys to the White House. I recommend it for all of your listeners. And there are 13 keys to the White House that he has measured going back to 1860. And he measured them going forward when he first wrote the book in 1980. And he's predicted the winner correctly in every election since 1980. And basically, the 13 keys, and the incumbent party has to have no more than 5 going against them in order to win the election. In the real election of 1940, there were only 2 keys going against the Democrats. But if you add the fact that they don't have an incumbent president as their candidate, if you add the fact they have a contentious primary, if you add the fact that they have a charismatic opponent in Wilkie, who comparatively would be charismatic as opposed to Hull, whereas he wasn't as compared to Roosevelt, and if you add the final factor that an anti-interventionist third-party candidate runs, saying the American people deserve a choice rather than an echo between 2 interventionists who could get at least 5% of the vote, and certainly that could have been done with a candidate like Wheeler, I imagine that Wheeler runs with Charles Lindbergh as his vice president. That ticket could easily get 7, 8, 10% of the vote, particularly in the Western states, and throw the election to Wilkie. So
I'll alter the dynamics of the Electoral College enough to change the outcome of the race, just by drawing voters away with enough support to change the majority.
Wilkie could have won the election. I think he could have won the election head-to-head against Cordell Hull, but he would have lost the popular vote. But with a third-party candidate drawing votes away from the Democrats in the West, that would have been enough to also hand him the popular vote by a narrow majority. And so now you have President Wilkie, who is in office with a Democrat Congress. The Republicans obviously will do better than they did in our timeline. However, they still have a huge minority in the Senate. The Democrats have an over 2-to-1 majority in the Senate. They have a much closer majority in the House, perhaps only a 20 seat majority in the House, but still he has to work with the Democrat Congress. So I would see Wilkie following the example of Roosevelt in keeping or hiring some Democrats to serve in key positions in his cabinet. Roosevelt picked 2 Republicans to run the Navy and the Army, Henry Stimson at War. Henry Stimson at the War Department, a former Republican Secretary of State, and Frank Knox, an anti-New Deal newspaper publisher from Chicago, as Secretary of the Navy. I would see Wilkie offering Cordell Hull, provided the campaign didn't get too nasty, the opportunity to stay on as Secretary of State and form sort of a coalition government, and seeing him pick a Democrat to serve as Secretary of the Treasury. And there's another name most of your listeners haven't heard of, a man named Lewis W. Douglas from Arizona, who was basically Barry Goldwater with a D by his name. Douglas was an old-fashioned Jeffersonian Democrat. His father had owned several mines in Arizona. He'd been a congressman from Arizona in the 1930s. And as a very young man, not even 40, he was at the 1932 convention a supporter of Roosevelt's, actually considered as a vice presidential candidate before they picked John Nance Garner. And then he was appointed as OMB director, Office of Management and Budget, under Franklin Roosevelt. And he was one of those Democrats who was a conservative who was brought in as part of Roosevelt's new administration. It's a little known fact that many of Roosevelt's advisors in the early days were conservative, fiscally conservative Democrats who wanted to roll back some of the spending programs of the Hoover administration. And Douglas was probably the leader of that group. He presented a budget that would be balanced, that would slash spending. But Roosevelt, of course, fairly quickly moved away from his initial conservative inclination and went to big spending. That caused a big rift with Douglas. He resigned about less than 2 years into office. He endorsed the Republican candidate in 1936, and he endorsed Wilkie in 1940. So I could see Wilkie bringing him in as Secretary of the Treasury. So you have Hull at State, Douglas at Treasury, he keeping Stimson at War and Knox at the Navy, and appointing Tom Dewey, his rival from the convention, as Attorney General. Perfect job for Wendell Wilkie. Dewey, he's been a successful prosecutor and DA of New York in fighting the mobsters and various other elements. Even had a movie made about him starring Humphrey Bogart as a Tom Dewey-like character. So now President Wilkie's in office, and the question is, how does this affect the course of World War II?
Yeah, and before we go there, and that's, I think, where we'll spend a good bit of the time here, we've talked here about the economic scenario. We talked about the two big backdrops that sort of sit behind the 1940 election. There's the looming tensions, the concerns about war, entanglements in Europe, entanglements in Asia. But this is also the back end. You know, I often been argued, I tend to hold to this point of view, that the thing that actually brought the Great Depression to an end was World War II, because it changed and altered everything, production, how business worked, everything else. The real catalyst that ends what we know as the Great Depression is actually World War II. But the Great Depression, unlike any other, I mean, there have been other economic panics and other economic recessions and crises in American history, but the Great Depression gets the name of the Great Depression because it was a very monumental challenge to capitalism. And you even mentioned some of the things that were going on there with ideas about communism, socialism globally. Those took root to a great degree in the United States just because of how severe the Great Depression was. That's why it actually came to the forefront, was on the stage.
Well, that's true. And there's the Great Depression is great in many ways because it was so long. It's much like the Great War in 1914 to 1918, how long and how bloody it was. The economy in 1929, when it first had the slump, it needn't have lasted as long as it did. The economy there were a couple of what looked like recoveries from 1929, 1932, but one of the reasons is that the government policies that were implemented were kept harming the economy rather than helping it. In fact, one of the scenarios, which I think would be also interesting to explore, is what if Calvin Coolidge had served a third term? And the historian Paul Johnson, who's written many great books, History of the Modern World, History of the American People, many other great books, he wrote in his History of the American People, he believes that had Coolidge been in office, he would have basically done what Harding did in 1921 during the great panic of and the depression, really, of 1919, 1921. Basically, Harding and his cabinet secretary of the treasury, Henry Mullen, Andrew Mullen, basically they cut spending, they cut taxes, and did nothing else. And this is back when the government's role in the economy was much smaller. So there wasn't as many gears to pull. So basically, they just pulled back government spending, didn't borrow, and just let the market purge itself of the bad assets and the bad, you know, the overpriced items, and let things come back to equilibrium. And within a year, the economy was growing again. Had Coolidge been in office, it's quite plausible that he would have done the same thing. He would not have raised taxes as Hoover did on both income and tariffs and many other things. And by 1933, the economy would have been back to a fairly decent shape. And the Democrats would have probably still won, but it would have been much smaller, and the New Deal would not have been necessary. And you would have had Franklin Roosevelt presiding over the good times of the 1930s rather than the Depression and the New Deal. So that's a experiment there. And also, I'll say this, historians have for many years thought that the Great Depression was ended by World War II, but some more recent research and work has brought forward a different hypothesis, that basically the Depression really didn't end. The market didn't really recover until after World War II, when Truman slashed spending, didn't cut taxes so much, but basically took off the wage and price controls, cut spending, and basically allowed the free market to get back to doing what it's best at. And this we did not see a real recovery without a wartime footing until the 1945-46, which of course also had the labor strike. So the economy didn't really get good again until 1947-48, when the Republicans took control of Congress and rolled back a lot of the New Deal programs and passed things like the Taft-Hartley Act. They say, unemployment, for example, went away during World War II, but when you draft 10 million men into the Army, of course unemployment goes away.
Yeah, your measures of what is working and not working as an economy are very different when you're in a war production mode. And as you mentioned, many of the able, the reason we have the image of Rosie the Riveter is Rosie needed to be in the factory because the guy that held that job before was somewhere in Europe or Asia in a theater of operations. And it's difficult to say what the economy would have done without the intervention of the war, because whether you want to argue that the war, helped bring the country out of recession through manufacturing production, that production was not the production that would have existed in a regular economy. And so it sort of puts the regular economic measures, as you well point out, there on hold until you get to after the war and things settle down even for a couple of years after the war, then to figure out, okay, where are we now and what needs to be done and what are the forces that are at play. So just to recap for our listeners, the alternate timeline here, of course, is that Roosevelt could not run. He was barred from running because something that is the equivalent of the 22nd Amendment exists in the Constitution and has existed since 1789. And again, as you mentioned before, that this reality, it's almost as if that reality did take place, because the precedent that Washington set was so respected, it was almost as if it was in the Constitution until we get to 1940. Where the violation is there. So as you mentioned, there's no additional butterfly effects because nobody had really violated or gone for a third term. They thought about it, but nobody had. And so we come to the 1940 election, and as you suggested, that the election that's contested is between Wilkie and Hull, and Wilkie is the winner. So the Republicans assume the presidency in 1941, and so President Wilkie has sworn in. You've mentioned already who some of the potential members of the cabinet are. And so we find ourselves in early 1941 with the Wilkie presidency, what's led up to this now. And now for the exploration of the alternative timeline, you started down this path and I sort of derailed you there, Brant. I guess the first question to ask is, what does the United States participation in what we know of today as World War II look like, where President Wilkie is leading foreign affairs for the United States versus President Roosevelt?
Well, it's hard to say, of course, for sure, but I think it would be very similar because Wilkie had was even more of an interventionist, if that were possible, than Roosevelt. And as leader of the Republican Party, he would have been able to command a lot more votes from Republicans for things like renewing the Selective Service Act in 1941. Which ended up passing by a tiny margin, I think with just one or two votes in the House. With Wilkie as the Republican president, the Republicans who had led the opposition to renewing the Selective Service Act would have been brought into line. Although I think that Wilkie, a lot of Republicans did not like Wilkie. They, particularly his rather naive style of campaigning, his idea of bringing Democrats over to vote for Republican, him as a Republican, a former Democrat, rather than turning out the base. He was a political neophyte, and it showed. In fact, in the book, in a recent book published about his campaign and his life, which is a very good book, I recommend to you. I'll remember the title of it in a minute. But it speaks of how the Republicans basically had to pull an intervention shortly after the Republican National Convention to basically show him that he was an idiot for thinking that there's going to be this. The Democrats for Wilkie committee was going to pull him over the top. They had to get serious. They had to organize. They had to turn out the faithful. Otherwise, there was no hope of winning the election. So I can see Wilkie having to make his peace with congressional Republicans. But on the other hand, as we've seen with President Trump, he also was an outsider. But winning is a great way of unifying your party. So there would be some hardcore isolationists and a few, moderate isolationists or non-interventionists who would kick their heels a little. But I imagine Wilkie would be able to pull most of the rank and file along with him. So we have the Selective Service Act renewed. We have a continued escalation The one question that would be interesting is, would Wilkie pursue the same path as Roosevelt in terms of seeking to provoke, depending on your view of Roosevelt? One school says that he was actively poking at the Japanese, trying to get them to attack us first in order to provoke a war, which hopefully he could hope to widen into Europe and go after his real enemy, which was the Germans. I think that that's probably giving Roosevelt a little too much credit for, you know, sneakiness. I think the historical record is pretty clear that he was actively seeking to provoke Germany to fire the first shot. But the problem was the Germans wouldn't take the bait.
Yeah. In fact, one of the interesting things here, we were talking off podcast about a podcast that I think is an interesting historical podcast. Dan Carlin produces a podcast called Hardcore History. If you're a hardcore history buff, it's aptly titled for you. You will like it. He goes after it hard. He's very articulate, and he's very good. And actually, one of the podcasts that he has out now relates to the rise of Japan in the pre-war period. And, you know, one of the things that's talked about there that's easy for us to forget, but it relates back to this, is that there was some question even after the Japanese choosing to bomb Pearl Harbor and undertake the action that was there that had to do with all kinds of – that's a whole other series of podcasts we could have about what leads Japan to that point and actually the role of America and others in – because of Japan's intervention in China and opposing that and sanctions and other things that led to some cases the Japanese sort of feeling like they were boxed in and needing the most important resource that they were going to need, which happened to be oil, that being another consideration there. But one of the things that people forget is we almost immediately assume that, well, of course, the attack at Pearl Harbor is from the Japanese. And of course, then we went to war with all of the Axis powers, with Japan, Germany, and Italy, but it was in fact an open question that if Germany had not chosen to declare war on the United States, which they did in support of Japan, I think that declaration actually was around December 11th. So it's been 4 or 5 days after the December 7th bombing at Pearl Harbor. Is, you know, one of the interesting what ifs of history is if Germany had never declared war on the United States, the United States would have definitely gone to war with Japan because of being provoked by the surprise attack there on Pearl Harbor. But would the United States have been as willing to go to war against Germany, who has not declared war upon it or provoked it in any way?
Well, precisely, and that historians have wondered at that. In perhaps one of the largest that is quite possibly the biggest what if in terms of Hitler's career as a wartime leader, is why did he declare war on the United States? The only thing perhaps asked more is why did he invade Russia when he did?
Right.
Declaring war on America is probably the biggest question that is asked, even more than invading Russia. And there were plenty of people after the war who said he had made a mistake, generals who talked about how that was a mistake. But at the time, if I remember my history correctly, at the time, no one advised him against it. And that needs to be remembered. So while it's certainly possible that he would not have declared war, he didn't have any advisors telling him not to do it. You know, today we say, well, that was transparently a stupid thing to do, yet none of his generals or his advisors advised him against it. And of course, by that time, Hitler was getting less and less receptive of advice he didn't like.
Right.
But still, if it was such a bad idea, nobody, you know, brought up the bad idea. So it's definitely something that we have to remember as students of history and alternative history. We have to try the best we can to go back and place ourselves at that moment in time, putting aside the fact that we know what's going to happen.
Right.
We have to try to put ourselves in the boots.
Our hindsight is always 20/20 because we have
exactly.
The benefit of hindsight.
We have to try to put ourselves in the boots or the shoes of those who were there. And I don't think that Wilkie would have been extremely different from Roosevelt in terms of the lead up to December 7th, 1941, except that since he was more anti-New Deal and would have had an administration with a lot more businessmen and Republicans in it, they would have tried to cut back a little on some of the excess spending of the New Deal and redirected that toward military projects, and also would have had a lot more Republican style businessmen and Chamber of Commerce types who were better at organizing things and fewer, social experimenters than from the New Deal days, which would have probably made for a more efficient administration early on in terms of war preparation. And also, this is more after the war, but there were a lot of people in the Roosevelt administration who were either sympathetic toward the Soviet Union or were outright spies for the Soviet Union, passing information law. Of course, the most famous is Alger Hiss, but there were others like Harry Dexter White, who worked very hard for Moscow's interests, and countless others, such as Whitaker Chambers, who later recanted his communism and was actually instrumental in bringing down Hiss. And of course, the Rosenbergs, Julius and Ethel Rosenberg, who were instrumental in stealing many secrets, including the secrets to the atomic bomb for the Soviets. So if many of those characters are no longer in the government, and they've left the scene. White, for example, worked at the Treasury Department and would have been out under the new administration. He wouldn't have been in the office anymore. So you would have seen a government that would have taken a much more Churchillian approach, if that's a word, toward the Soviet Union, in that you would have seen them say, well, we will work with the Russians, the Soviets, in as much as they will help us defeat the Germans. But we are under no illusions as to their post-war ambitions, to the fact that we do not want anything to do with them. And we certainly don't see communism as the wave of the future. I think that's the key difference, in terms of U.S.-Soviet relations from a Wilkie administration rather than a Roosevelt administration, is that in his heart, I think Roosevelt viewed communism or a milder form of it as the way of the future. And certainly many in his administration viewed it as the way of the future. Not all, but many. And they advised him. And also you have to remember that Roosevelt was very much anti-British Empire. And that prejudice colored his relationship with Churchill and Stalin. You take Wilkie, who, although he was an internationalist and even a world federalist, he thought that there should be a global government. From my reading of him, I don't see his opposition to the British Empire as being as strident as Roosevelt's, he would have been much more anti-communist. So that would have been a significant, in that many of the bad decisions that were made by the Roosevelt administration and many of the secrets that were stolen by communist agents, those things would not have happened under a Wilkie administration. So we get to 1941, we get to the attack on Pearl Harbor. The war begins very similar. And one thing which we have not talked about is, would Wilkie have kept on all of the generals and admirals leading at the time of Roosevelt's leaving office, including the chief of staff, General George C. Marshall? Would he have been retained in his post or replaced by someone else, like, for example, a recently retired Army chief of staff who was the most popular general among Republicans, a general some people may have heard of by the name of Douglas MacArthur?
Yeah, we often don't think about the change in military leadership, but those are appointed positions that are controlled by the executive, and so that we tend to just think, well, of course it would have been that same person because it would have been that same person, but that's not the way that worked. And so would that have made a difference? I mean, Marshall certainly, the role that Marshall played. In fact, one of the interesting things I mentioned in the other podcast, Carlin talking in the Hardcore History podcast about one of the most unimaginable things in so many ways that actually happened during World War II between the United States and Great Britain was the willingness to place their troops under the command of generals or leaders from the other nation, which was, when you think about it, is not a normal, I guess in very, very, very modern terms, some of the coalitions like, the coalition in the Gulf War, things like that. But this part of the reason you never saw the Germans and the Japanese fighting together that way was it's hard to imagine a Wehrmacht division placed under a Japanese general or vice versa. I mean, that just wasn't going to happen. And so the leadership matters, and how that worked out would have mattered. And you're right, the George Marshall and Douglas MacArthur are very different personalities with very different skill sets coming into the role, and how that might have played out. Not in necessarily the local theater actions during World War II, but what the general strategy was overall could have been a different outcome.
Yeah, indeed. I think that Marshall would have probably been retained in his post. He had done a good job of organizing through 1940, and seeing is and it's generally not good to change horses in midstream when you're in the middle of preparing to fight a war, and having had a new having passed the reins from one president to the to another, it probably would have been enough horse switching in midstream for one president. So I would imagine Marshall would remain in his position. However, I think that MacArthur would have certainly been recalled to active duty as he was under Roosevelt, and probably would have had a slightly better connection to the White House, not necessarily because he and Wilkie were friends. I don't believe they were, but he would have had many friends in the new Republican administration who remembered him well, and he would have had a lot more allies rather than begrudging allies or pseudo opponents, semi opponents, as he did in the Roosevelt administration.
Right.
So, but that probably would not have been enough, though, to save, unfortunately, to save our gallant men on Bataan and Corregidor. And MacArthur still would have been boxed into a corner and forced to evacuate. Although I wonder if Wilkie would have given him the order. Because y'all, and then here's something else, another factor to consider. One of the reasons that historians believe that one of the reasons MacArthur was not relieved of duty for after surprise attack on Manila, where the Japanese were able to destroy most of MacArthur's Air Force on the ground on December 7th and December 8th, was that as the leading Republican general in the country, Roosevelt could not afford to remove such a distinguished American general. He needed to bring the nation together. That's why he had a Republican Secretary of War and Secretary of the Navy. And the political fallout would have been too difficult. Plus, MacArthur's on the other side of the world fighting the Japanese. And to recall him in the middle of combat would have also looked very bad. But you got to ask yourself, if Wendell Wilkie's president and he doesn't feel that same need to be bipartisan, would he have relieved MacArthur of command and brought him back to the United States in disgrace? It's definitely a legitimate question. And the whole course of the war could have been very different in the Pacific, because whatever people think of MacArthur, there's no questioning that he was a brilliant strategist. And probably the most brilliant American general and success in terms of both his mental and just military success that this nation has ever produced. If you look at his success in isolating the Japanese in the first, he fought against superior odds in the New Guinea campaign in 1942. He had the tactical and strategic insight to not stand on the defensive and wait for the Japanese to invade Australia, which would have been a horrible thing. He took the fight to them in the jungles of New Guinea. And then by 1943, having built up enough strength, began to leapfrog main Japanese positions, isolating huge garrisons, cutting off their supplies and going along, leapfrogging along New Guinea and eventually to Palau, halfway between New Guinea and the Philippines, and eventually being able to strike at the Philippines. Right. Another American general would have most likely taken a more Eisenhower-like approach of knocking out one Japanese base at a time, which would have meant the war would have lasted much longer. And the casualties would have been much more grievous. It's worth noting that MacArthur, in his campaigns of 1942 and 1943 in New Guinea, lost fewer American dead than in the single Battle of Anzio in the Italian campaign. So not only was he successful, but he delivered it with a much, much smaller butcher's bill and casualty list than the generals in Europe.
And the other thing that people agreed, the other thing that people forget is the policy under Roosevelt during World War II, because of the deal that was struck, the Atlantic Charter, the other things that were produced as a result of the early days of planning for the Allied activities, was that it was a Europe first approach.
It would have stayed that same
way. It would have stayed that way for the obvious reasons, but what that meant was everything you just described there. It's not that there weren't forces that were sent to the Pacific theater, but the Pacific theater did not receive the bulk of the attention. They were left to fight, as you well point out there, a strategic defensive type of campaign that they were able to do tactically offensive things inside of a general defensive strategic arrangement until such time as forces could be brought to bear to do other things. And that required a certain amount of delicacy in terms of the skill of a commander to be able to do that.
That is absolutely correct. As I recall, I don't recall the exact number, but in terms of the munitions and the manpower available to Europe versus the Pacific, I believe that Marge, that the Pacific got either between 10 and 25%. I know it wasn't more than 25, and it might have been as little as 10. I think it was closer to 20, if I remember correctly. But in other words, for every tank, for every munition, every bullet that went to, every four bullets that went to Europe, one went to the Pacific.
Right.
So MacArthur was definitely in a more difficult position. And there were other able generals out there, but MacArthur was fairly unique in his way of approaching warfare of the generals of the Pacific. So, like I say, had he not been there, you would have seen a much longer, more costly campaign throughout the Pacific campaign. But I'm going to assume that the Republicans would have stuck by him, even if Wilkie might have wanted to get rid of him. They would have realized it would have been bad to recall a general who's actually facing the enemy in the field. So the Pacific remains pretty much the same. And really, I would say most of the war remains the same. Of course, that's a dangerous thing to say. I'm sure there are many military history buffs who could point out very specific things that only a Roosevelt would have done in terms of generals hired or fired. And we'll be sending in comments to us for this episode. But assuming that it remains roughly the same, we come to 1943. And here's where it really gets neat. Wilkie had an interesting relationship, interesting in quotation marks, with Madam Chiang Kai-shek. I'll leave those of you, your listeners, with a more amorous frame of mind to read the history on that. But suffice it to say that Wilkie had a very great interest in the Far East, in China, and its future as part of the democratic world. So he would have definitely taken a greater interest in what was going on in Asia than a president Roosevelt would have. But also, you got to remember that Wendell Wilkie has the distinction, him and his vice presidential candidate in the real life, Charles McNary, of being the only two men, the presidential ticket, to die within the 4 years of their campaign. McNary died in 1940, mm-hmm. I believe, in early 1944, and Wilkie died in October, I believe, of 1944. Now, it's been said that the presidency cuts a year off a man's life for every year he's in office. In other words, it ages you twice as fast. Even if you took a less, and of course, in the middle of World War II, one could argue it stretches it even more than that.
That ratio is probably not 2 to 1, but maybe like 4 to 1 or something like that.
Well, exactly. One need only look at Franklin Roosevelt in 1940 to 1945 to see what being president in the middle of the greatest war in history can do to a man. However, let's just say that it only takes a year off Wilkie's life, and he dies in October of 1943. His vice president, as we have said in this scenario, is not Charles McNary, who'd be dead within 6 months, but rather a much healthier 60-year-old vice president, Arthur James, former governor of Pennsylvania, who very little is known about. You look at his Wikipedia bio, it's very, very small. You might call him the Harry Truman.
That's the first thing that popped into my mind. Who knew who Harry Truman was, right?
Well, precisely. And so you would. But James, interestingly, lived to be 90 years old. He died in 1973. So dying in office would not have been a problem as far as this general is concerned. In fact, Harry Truman, if I recall, was born in 1884, died in 1973. Arthur James was born in 1883, if I recall correctly, and died in 1973. So his years are almost precisely correlating with Harry Truman's. And he was, although their lives other than that were very different. One was a conservative Republican, the other a New Deal Democrat. One was a successful businessman, the other a unsuccessful haberdasher and machine politician. But I will assume that James is a fairly conventional Republican. He will continue the Wilkie policy to win the war. And you go into 1944 now with the war on the verge of being won. And a key difference by 1944, here's where it gets interesting. We get to 1944. The war is going well in Europe. The landings in D-Day have been successful. But now there's this opportunity to push into Germany and to go for Berlin. You remember that Eisenhower was careful as far as not stepping on Soviet toes in terms of where the two armies would land at the end of the war. If you have a Republican president who is going to be staunchly anti-communist, they will want as little ground to be ceded to the Russians as possible. So does that mean that the Americans drive harder for Berlin and push all the way back to to the border of what is now Poland and Germany, so that the modern, so that all of Germany is in the Western sphere of influence. Another big question is, does the fact of the Soviets pushing into Eastern Europe become a major factor? Because Wendell Willkie was very sensitive to the plight of the Poles and other peoples. He himself was German, descendant of Germans, but he was very much a liberal German. His ancestors had been part of the 1848 revolution, and they despised Prussian imperialism. But he also was sensitive to the Poles and other captive peoples held in Eastern Europe. Would his anti-communism and Churchill's fear of the Soviets' imperial ambitions in Eastern Europe have caused them to reroute the D-Day invasion, say, to the Balkans? Because they tricked the Germans into thinking they were going to invade the Balkans, and they also tricked the Germans to think they were going to invade Calais.
Right.
So imagine if if Churchill had persuaded Willkie that we need to not only win the war, but we need to keep the Soviets out of as much of Europe as possible. So imagine, instead of the Anzio invasion, the invasion of southern France and the invasion of northern France, all that effort is concentrated with a few diversionary psyops. All that effort is concentrated in an invasion of the Balkans in Greece or along the Yugoslav coast. And of course, though, that's a very mountainous region, so you could see them getting bogged down. But also, Tito's partisans were operating behind German lines and made life very difficult for the Germans in the Balkans and Yugoslavia. So that might have been a successful maneuver. I doubt they would have sent as big an army in there as they did to D-Day, but it's very possible that a invasion force, perhaps twice the size of the force that invaded southern France, pushes into the Balkans in early 1944 and makes some headway in driving up into Bulgaria, through Greece and Bulgaria. And the Romanians, you have to remember, and the Bulgarians were looking for an excuse to get out of the war by 1944. So it's quite possible that just like the Italians pretty much surrendered even before the Americans landed, they sued for peace right before the Americans landed in Italy. You could see Bulgaria and Romania breaking with the Germans in early 1944 if the Allies landed a big army in Greece and started pushing north into the other weak Axis powers. So imagine a scenario where the Balkans, the Soviets are kept out of the Balkans, the Soviets push into Poland, spend most of the time pushing into Poland, pushing harder for Berlin, which means they get to it earlier. We get to around the same line as we do on the Elbe, because some of those divisions that would have been used in the Western Front are used instead in the Balkans. So we find ourselves in a scenario now where Romania, Bulgaria, Yugoslavia are under the Western Allied influence, and Poland and East Germany are under the Soviet influence. Czechoslovakia and Hungary and Austria, we probably get the southern two. So Hungary and Austria are in our sphere of influence, and the Soviets probably get control of Czechoslovakia. So the Balkans, which would of course become Soviet client states, will now remain under the Allied sphere of influence, and that would be a very interesting process, because there were some very strong nationalist and fascist organizations in Romania and Hungary in particular that would have had to be defascistized under a Western government, much like the French regime and Vichy was deposed, and a lot of people were shot after the Allies retook France. One of the less known chapters in French history is the quasi-civil war that was taking place in France from 1940 to 1945, when the Vichy government was basically the right-wing traditionalist government trying to hold back the communists. And General de Gaulle made an alliance of convenience with the leftists and the Marxists to fight them. And of course, the French resistance was basically the French left fighting underground against the French right, which was in collaboration with the Germans. And then when they came back in, they shot a lot of people, killed a lot of people in extrajudicial manner. And of course, the joke about it is that Charles de Gaulle today is seen as a Napoleonic strongman and right winger. But at the time, he worked with a lot of leftists to basically do in France the opposite of what was done in Spain. The right wing military succeeded in overthrowing the communist-backed Spanish Republican government, whereas in France, the military-backed left-wing succeeded, and the Allied-backed left-wing succeeded in overthrowing the Germans, and of course their puppets in the Vichy government. So there's a lot to unpack there, but 1944, Wilkie's been dead for a year. His vice president's renominated. And the question is, with the war going well, and obviously within, you know, a year of being won, who is going to be the Democrat candidate and what are they going to run on? Are they going to run on winning the war? Are they going to talk about rebuilding the New Deal after the war? Who wins there?
Right.
And who runs?
That is where, you know, you mentioned the butterfly effect earlier. Now you start having so many variables that start playing in. It's not a simple, well, it's this or that kind of path that you get to there. There's multiple factors that can be going on. But just the very fact, there is a change in leadership in the real timeline when Roosevelt dies and Truman assumes the presidency. But that is so much later in the war effort. Mm-hmm.
Wilkie will be the same thing. Wilkie is so similar in that. See, and you notice the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Right, right.
President Roosevelt died in office, and so would President Wilkie, probably in the summer or fall of 1943. And although I will say that his health had been deteriorating, but he had ignored some of the signs of it. As president, he probably would have had a more stricter health regimen, and his doctors would have been more careful to observe his health. However, and that would have probably helped him along a little, but being that he was under a great strain and the disease, I believe he died of a heart condition. That's really not something you can fix in 1940s medicine with regular checkups.
Right.
So he would have almost certainly had succumbed nonetheless. And then his vice president would have probably been reelected since the war was still ongoing. And even though the war would have been much closer to victory, still the war would have been ongoing. And as a result, they would have wanted to stay with the Republicans, who looked like they were going to win the war. And you can be sure that Republicans would have pointed out that after the war, you want a guy who's going to be strong in dealing with the Russians. It would have been very quiet. But there would have been plenty of whisper campaigns by Republican operatives, particularly in the ethnic neighborhoods, like the Polish neighborhoods in the various big cities, saying, well, you know, Wilkie is going to be tough, or actually President James. You know, President James will be tough with the communists and make sure that Poland is free after the war. But you know those socialist Democrats, you know, after all, you know what USSR stands for, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics.
You can't trust
those Democrats. They'll give away the store. They'll let Stalin roll over Poland. And that would have been, like I say, very quiet. And the Republicans would have officially denounced it. But ethnic politics in the big cities of America was very, very nasty. So you can be sure there would have been talk of that during the 1944 campaign. But the Republicans win, and President James gets a final term, because remember, he can't run for a third term because of the alternate 22nd Amendment, which of course been one of the original 10, or in this case 11 amendments. That's another thing too, for people who like things in neat orders, it wouldn't have been 10 Bill of Rights, it would have been 11.
Right. So, and who knows, this might have been one of the higher ones, so instead of talking about might not be pleading the fifth, they might be pleading the seventh, or, you know, instead of talking about your Second Amendment rights to bear arms, you may have been talking about your Third Amendment rights to bear arms. Those seem like small things, but our language would be very potentially different.
Exactly. People would be going around hashtag 3A.
Yeah. Yeah. One of the things I want to ask you there, Brent, just one of the things that occurred, and I'm always amazed when we record episodes, the things that I've thought about before, but then the things that I don't think about till I'm in the middle of it. But just really thinking about just how this plays out, I'm going to jump way ahead here, how this plays out, because what you do see happen so often, 30, 40, 50 years down the road in American politics everywhere, but American politics as well, is you'll see that concept of grave robbing, you know, where one party will actually go back and pull quotes from a famous personage, a persona of the other party back from a different era. And so, you know, you'll see you see this to varying degrees, but you may see a Republican, for example, quote Roosevelt in some context that's related to the importance of strength during World War II or something like that. It's a tactic that's used. And so, you know, one of the things that I was immediately thinking about there was, okay, with the Republicans being the party of victory, if you will, because of holding the presidency during World War II, you know, how does that play out in the 60s and the 70s? Obviously, not just in what, first of all, you've mentioned it already, would there be the same type of Cold War that we think of today in terms of how the end of the Second World War might have looked differently in the areas of occupation and maybe the desire to go ahead and sort of take the patent approach of, we got an army, they're trained and they're here, let's go ahead and finish this thing kind of approach, versus what maybe 30 or 40 years down the road, where the parties do still carry over something of a hangover, positive or negative, from the events of a generation before.
Well, that's a great point, and people forget about this today, but after World War II, the Democrats had a real, for about three years, the Democrats had a real advantage on the foreign policy front, because even though Americans wanted to come back from the war and demilitarize and, you know, get the young men out of uniform, get them back to civilian life, in terms of more of the morality play, the Republicans had been in a real bind, because they had been the party as the opposition party. And believe me, if the Democrats had been the opposition in the first year of the Wilk administration, you can be sure that they would have been the party attacking him for being a warmonger. That's just the way politics is. You see it right now. The Democrat Party used to be the party of peace. Now that Trump is trying to get us out of various conflicts in the world, they're the party of war. It's just the way the opposition party works. Whatever the president wants, they're against it. But that said, the Democrats in our timeline, the real world timeline, they had a big advantage, because they had been the party that had won the war, that had been for the war. The Republicans had been against it. They had been the party that wanted to fight the fascists. The Republicans were seen as, rightly or wrongly, as fascism was seen as a right wing phenomena. Therefore, Republicans being on the right of the political spectrum, you know, they, you know, would be a little softer on that, just in the same way that socialists and liberals of a more progressive variety tend to look at communists as sort of wayward cousins, but generally on the same path, if not the same methods. You know, they say a communist is an honest socialist, or a communist is a socialist with a gun in his hand instead of a ballot paper in his hand. But still, all that changed in 1948 and not in the early 50s. And this is why there are two men who the left reviled, desperately reviled. One of them died too young to be able to rehabilitate himself, and the other was able to do so to some extent. And those two men, of course, were Richard Nixon and Joseph McCarthy. Because of those two men, the Democrat Party to this very day has a foreign policy and macho deficiency problem, which they are very conscientious of. Hillary Clinton was beating the war drums in 2016 due to the legacy of Nixon and McCarthy, because Nixon was responsible for bringing down Alger Hiss. Harry Truman was a dedicated anti-communist, but he was also a very big partisan who couldn't stand to admit that he had been, you know, sheltering communists or communist spies. He didn't know Hiss was a spy or a communist, but he just couldn't give the satisfaction to the Republicans. And so they didn't cooperate as well as they should have. And as a result, it became more and more of the idea sinking into the American people that if you want to fight the communists, you can't really trust the Republicans the Democrats like you can the Republicans. And then, of course, when McCarthy started talking about communists in the State Department and various other individuals, although he wasn't as successful in nailing down an individual, there were enough communists and fellow travelers that were revealed around that time that it put in the mind of the American people that if you want to win, if you want to fight the communists, you pick a Republican, because they can be trusted to go toe-to-toe with them. And to this day, the Democrats have never been able to fully shake that reputation. Now, in this scenario, the Republicans have won World War II, so you can't call them soft on fascism. They're also standing up against the Soviets in the post-war era, which is the most interesting part, because you think about the post-Soviet, you think about the post-World War II world. If the Allies have pushed into the Balkans, that means there's no need for a Marshall Plan to Greece and Turkey, and because the Allies will be controlling the Balkans. We'll control Romania. We control Bulgaria. We have Greece. We have Yugoslavia, which would probably be similar to what it is now, run by Tito, but more of a social democrat variety Tito rather than an independent communist as he was. And of course, Albania, which is run by militant communists, would not be run by communists, and neither would Hungary. So these nations would be in our sphere of influence, which means, of course, number one, the Soviets will be more on a hair trigger in terms of defense in depth. The big reason Stalin pushed into Eastern Europe was to give him a defense in depth against a future German or allied, Western allied attack against Russia. Well, now the allied border is in Romania, just a short, you know, a couple hundred miles from Kiev and right on the border of Ukraine. So they're going to be a lot more hair triggered, a lot more prone to be more belligerent. But no Marshall Plan means that there's a lot less foreign aid budget, a lot less attitude towards spending on foreign aid. Also, NATO would have probably still been formed, but it would have been of a slightly different variety because President James would probably have been far less of a globalist, a world federalist than Wilkie. And he would have been more influenced by senators like Robert Taft, who would have advised less of a permanent commitment in Europe, more of a one step at a time. You know, sure, we want to ally ourselves against the Soviets, help the British or the Germans, but we're not going to commit ourselves open-endedly to whatever happens. I mean, what if in 20 years from now, the Germans provoke the Soviets and they're in the wrong, and now we're committed ourselves open-endedly to fight on their side? That was the point of view of the Taft faction. But another big factor is a lot of people in the Truman administration were working to help Moscow, people like Harry Dexter White and Alger Hiss, and also helping them in places like China. It's quite possible that China would never have gone communist under a Republican administration, because one of the big factors in that was that the United States withdrew its funding from the government in China. It's a little known fact that Chiang's government finally collapsed when we basically pulled the financial plug, hyperinflation set in, and they weren't able to pay their bills. If the United States had continued backing them financially, Chiang could have held on and possibly won the war, or at the very least have a sort of a DMZ arrangement where perhaps southern China, south of the Yangtze River, is under his control, and northern China and Manchuria is under the control of Mao. But we certainly would not have had Red China, and there would have been no issue about who lost China. Right. So by 1948, the Democrats would get back into power, but it would be a very different Democrat Party, where the Democrat right, the conservative Democrats, are a lot more ascendant, have a lot more respectability. There's certainly no stigma of being communist appeaser or coddling communists like Hiss on the Democrat Party. And so the Democrats would have been, the Democrat liberals and leftists like Henry A. Wallace would have been far more open. But on the other hand, there would have been conservative Democrats who would have been much more anti-communist. So I think that would have a major impact on American foreign policy, in that the leftists would have been a lot, in some ways, more emboldened within the Democrat Party, but also would have had less influence overall, because the Republicans would not have exposed Democrat, soft handling of communists.
Yeah. Well, the last things we'll sort of cover here as we sort of bring things to a close. Something tells me we're going to revisit in future episodes of the podcast some of the what ifs that flow off of this, because there's so many. World War II and the events leading up to, and the events itself, military history in general, are great nexus points, as you well know, for alternate history. But I want to ask the question, Brent, and ask you to sort of focus on that. So imagine we now have, as we've already talked about, it's a Wilkie win in 1940, but by the time we get towards the end of World War II, it's a James presidency because of Wilkie's health and him dying while in office. So we've talked about the parallels then between President James and President Truman in those. So do you see the scenario under which, faced with the same circumstances or maybe slightly different circumstances, the United States now has this new super weapon, the war in the Pacific, or maybe even the war in Europe, has not yet been won, and now President James has that crucial decision which faced President Truman of, do we use an atomic bomb?
Well, one nice thing about Arthur James is that so little is known about him, I don't think anyone's even written a biography of him, that you could, like a blank canvas, you could paint almost anything you wanted, but onto that particular presidency. But being practical, I would say that, you know, he, as a businessman and a Republican of his era, he would have been about, you know, what's practical, what makes good sense. We have a weapon that can potentially end this war. It'll make it a lot easier for us to win. The body count will be much less. Therefore, absolutely, let's use it. I mean, there's no second thought about it. Republicans are typically stereotyped, rightly or wrongly, as being the party of efficiency and what makes common sense, rather than, you know, sentimentality and what's the you know, more emotional or moral thing to do. You could picture a liberal Democrat agonizing over, you know, is this the right thing to do? And just a Chamber of Commerce Republican coming in saying, what do you mean, is it the right thing to do? We're going to kill Japs. Drop the bomb. Drop 10 of them if that's what it takes to win the war. So I don't think that would have been a problem at all. But as you say that, I just remembered, in 1946, the Republicans had a big wave here in the reaction to the Democrats. With a Republican administration, you would not have seen that. You would have seen the Democrats have a good year in the midterms and win Congress, hold Congress. They probably would have held it during the entirety of the 8 years of the GOP administration. But that also would have meant, most likely, that a certain young lawyer from Southern California would not have defeated Congressman Jerry Voorhees down in the Los Angeles. And of course, we all know that I'm talking about Richard Nixon. Now, Richard Nixon was a very ambitious young man, and chances are he probably would have gotten into office eventually in some form and probably risen to high office, perhaps the presidency. But the absence of him getting into office right when he did, the absence of the Hiss case, since Hiss would be a ex-FDR administration official rather than an existing administration official, and the fact that the Democrats would have been in office in 1948 and going into 52, there's no Korean War, which means there's not really a need for a general president like Eisenhower. Eisenhower probably never becomes president, or if he does, it would perhaps even be in 1948 as a Democrat, and Richard Nixon doesn't get anywhere near the White House for the foreseeable future, perhaps ever, because the butterfly effects of that at this point are just too massive to comprehend.
Right, right. Does
John F. Kennedy even become president?
Right. Yeah, you point out very well there. It gets to the point where you get two things that are happening. The variables are so many you can solve the equation almost any way you want to. And then to your point, for some of the characters and personages that we have in history, we know so little about them, relatively speaking, because of what they did not have to do, that you can almost then make the case for anything that you wanted them to do. The blank slate concept, I think, is a very good way to look at that. The thing that caused me to prompt me to ask that question or anything else is, you know, if you look back on the decision that Truman made to drop the bomb, there were a lot of factors going into that. One of them being obviously the weighing the balance between the loss of life, loss of Japanese life, in this case, even civilian/military life as a result of dropping the bomb, compared to the loss of American life and actually executing an invasion of the Japanese mainland, where you see numbers there, conservative numbers there of losses for American forces, maybe perhaps being as many as a million men.
Yes.
And you can make arguments for even more. And certainly there's the precedent for looking at how the Japanese fought defensive actions just in terms of their mentality as
Okinawa.
A people. Yeah, exactly. You look at that and you go, that was not even a mainland island that was there. But, you know, the other thing that's often argued there, which I believe is a true point, is that Truman makes that decision, and part of the timing for that is to draw the war to a close quickly before the Soviets can really – the Soviets do declare war on Japan to sort of – and actually – I guess they'd already declared war on Japan, but they start wanting to take action after the end of the war.
Actually,
in Europe.
Well, actually,
and Truman is looking to stifle their influence in the Far East.
Well, that's a good point. There's an argument that says that Truman wanted the Soviets to know that we had a bomb and were willing to use it. But that is one of the very interesting parts at the end of the war there that. And there's been a lot of scholarship about this. Oliver Stone did a documentary about it. And, you know, I'm not suggesting Oliver Stone is a great, reliable source of history. But and there's always two sides to this. But his interpretation of various new papers that have come to light in the Japanese military and political records and cabinet minutes basically indicates this. The Japanese, by 1945, were willing to give up, provided we guaranteed the life of the emperor and something like a decent post-war future. However, the United States was not prepared to negotiate on that basis. Basically, the Japanese were asking that we not kill the emperor.
Right.
And we were not prepared to make that deal. Of course, it turns out that under Douglas MacArthur's excellent stewardship and vice, basically being the viceroy of Japan, we did not, in fact, do anything against the emperor and were able to successfully leverage his respect among the Japanese people to make them into an ally and to defame them as an imperial power. However, the Japanese didn't know that at the time, and they would refuse to surrender without that guarantee. Now, here's the tricky part. People think that the atomic bomb ended the war, but these documents that have been uncovered in the last 10 years seem to indicate that it was not the that was not the bomb. It was the Soviet Union. And here's why. The Japanese had not been at war with the Soviets since a border skirmish in 1939. They had a non-aggression, non-attack policy. It served both interests. The Japanese didn't want to have to fight the Soviets while they were fighting us, and the Soviets didn't want an enemy on their flank when they're still fighting the Germans.
Correct.
The Japanese wanted the Soviets to intervene as the arbiter of a peace between them and the United States. The Soviets led the Japanese to believe they would do such a thing while they were building up their forces, transferring several million men and countless thousands of tanks and trucks from the Western Front to the Eastern Front. They were waiting to invade Manchuria, but they led the Japanese to believe they would make peace. They would be peace brokers. So the Japanese are being firebombed by Curtis LeMay's Air Force, the incendiary bombs destroying the Japanese paper houses, just incredible devastation, even more than an atomic blast. You got to remember, the atomic bombs were much weaker than modern nuclear weapons. And at the end of the day, when you see the devastation of places like the firebombing of Dresden, the firebombing of Tokyo, the atomic bomb doesn't look all that terrible. I mean, you know, the people who are looking at it basically say, okay, I got one bomb that can do the damage of 1,000 incendiary bombs. So I drop one bomb on the city, or I drop 1,000 on the incendiary bombs in this other city. Doesn't really matter. People still die. You know, places flattened. Doesn't really make much difference. So they didn't have that same thought about nuclear weapons we have today. So the Japanese get bombed at Hiroshima. They still don't surrender. And why would they? The effect is not all that different than what happened at Tokyo, and many other places. So we bombed Nagasaki. They still don't surrender. Now we got a problem. We only have two working bombs. What happens if they still don't surrender and we got to bomb them again? Well, we can't. We have to go back to regular weapons. But shortly after Nagasaki, the Soviet Union invades Manchuria. Now the Japanese know they have no one to arbitrate for them. And worse, it now becomes a race against the clock. Do the Americans invade Japan or do the Soviets? The Americans might dethrone the emperor. The Soviets definitely will dethrone the emperor. So at this point, the Japanese cabinet says we have to throw ourselves on the mercy of the Americans. And they made a wise choice.
Right.
But one could argue that had the Americans agreed to the Japanese request for life of the emperor, the bomb would not have been necessary. Or if the Soviets had gotten in the war sooner, the bomb would not have been necessary. And at the end of the day, however, incredible loss of life in that war, the loss of life by the Japanese, the firebombings, Japan is so massive that whether or not the bomb itself was used in terms of the morality of it is far less significant when you look at the whole grand scheme of things. In other words, had Nagasaki and Hiroshima, which had been spared in order to be targets for the bomb, had they not been hit with an atom bomb, LeMay would flatten them with incendiary bombs. So the same people would have almost certainly died, just right, in slightly different ways and perhaps in an even more gruesome fashion. One could argue that the blast of an atomic bomb is a far more merciful way to go than to be slowly asphyxiated or burned alive with incendiary bombs.
Right, and then the geopolitics of the nuclear age come to be. So you can imagine perhaps a scenario where there's no, as you mentioned, they are under a different mode of surrender for the Japanese, where there's no need to drop the bomb, and so we now have this weapon that everyone knows in theory works, but it's never actually been, you know, put into practice. And do we have the same nuclear specter with no Hiroshima or Nagasaki? I don't know the answer to that question. That also gets starting out into the question of how things are perceived, because you're right, radiation the impacts of radiation, the other things that we see there are horrible. But as you well point out, if you see any photos or any the film exists as well of conventional bombing when it's done in mass, is nothing that is less horrific. So it's as you point out, it's just a question of, you know, how do you like your horror, which is a sad thing to be thinking or contemplating, but nonetheless the case. So we're about an hour and a half in, so we probably do need to wrap things to a close. Brent, you've been what I expected you to be, which is not only knowledgeable but articulate and thought-provoking, which are all of those are good things for what we endeavor to do here on A Fork in Time. So before we sort of shut things down for this discussion and just ask you if you have any closing thoughts on the topic or anything that we might not have covered, that if I don't say this, Don, I'm going to explode, so I got to get it out there.
Well, I just wanted to say thank you so much. I love what you're doing. It's a privilege to be a part of it and to support it in my small way. I'd encourage everyone to join on Patreon and become a supporter, because I'm sure that just about everyone listening has at one time thought about, well, I'd like to do a podcast or a video podcast about alternative history and things that have been kicking around in my head. Well, you've thought, I'll do it later. Well, you have an opportunity to support someone doing it now, and that way you can get all the benefits and only have to do a fraction of the work. In fact, none of the work. And all you have to do is give your $10 or $20 a month and submit an occasional script idea. Now, how could you beat a deal like that?
I'm actually in sales. That's what I do as for my regular profession. That's how I pay the bills. And I think you did an excellent job of selling one of the great benefits of the podcast. And as I mentioned, I think on the very introductory thing, when I this had been rolling around in my head and my daughter said, I don't want to forget Alexis because she's a vital part of this as well. But for a couple of years, it was just finally, well, I'm just going to do it. And part of the reason that I did it was not that I didn't find other sources out there. We were talking about some of the sources on the internet, alternate history forums and boards. And I mean, there's places to go on the internet to talk alternate history or counterfactuals. But I really hadn't found, and I have now subsequently found, a podcast that was doing it. And so it was marrying my love of the forum and the mechanism of a podcast with a topic that I like. And so I do encourage and I appreciate what Brent said there and what he's indicating there. But again, one of the things that Alexis and I mentioned on the on sort of the retrospective as we were 25 episodes in is we were seeking to create a community. And one of the cool things to me about that I've already discovered through some of the feedback that I've had, and Brent is representative of that, is the opportunity to find people who are of like mind. Sometimes they have the same thoughts, sometimes they have different ones, but a chance to engage in conversation. And actually something that you and I were talking about off podcast, off mic, Brent, was the fact that sometimes it's actually possible to explore topics that can be difficult to explore when you're talking about them in the real historical context. They can be sensitive things, but when you move them over into the realm of the hypothetical, the counterfactual, what if, that's why science fiction can sometimes challenge or look at issues that are tougher for us to deal with. But because we're dealing with them in an alternative fashion and a what if and a hypothetical, doesn't make the conversation about them any less relevant. In fact, in some ways, it makes it more relevant because we can think about them aside from the realities that we know in the concepts or conceptually, if that makes any sense. And that's actually one of the things that I enjoy a great deal about looking at alternative history is I'm reminded, I think I've said this before as well, that I am not skilled at all. I was a good student, but foreign language is not my forte, although I took 2 years of Latin when I was in college. But what I do remember about going through that process of learning another language was you learned your own language better because you have to do that translation process. You have to know English better, for example, to translate into another language. And I think the same thing is true in history. We get to understand what really happened in history better when we understand what the alternatives might have been. Going through that exercise actually brings us to that. So
absolutely, and everyone should. It is definitely true that you will not find better read students of history than people who are fans of alternative history. There's no question about it. Now, there are also some pretty uninformed people in the community as well, but by and large, you have to really know your history to appreciate the divergence, the fork in time.
I agree.
And so it's a great way to learn, and it's a great way to think about our own time. And for any, this isn't true anymore. People are, the alternative history genre is pretty much established now and respectable. But there was a time when it wasn't so. But I will say this, every one of us is an alternative historian. We ask ourselves, what if, all the time? What right. if I'd asked that girl out? What if I had not quit my job when I did? What if I had done this? What if I had done that? We ask ourselves about the forks in our own road all the time. And we do it about our contemporary politics, and we do about it about things, life events. So this is just a part of what we do all the time. And it helps us to understand in a way that you can't with conventional history, the mind and the times of those who came before us. You right. can't truly appreciate what Churchill or Lincoln or Roosevelt or Washington was thinking until you've appreciated what they might have done.
Well put. Well put. You put it better than I did, Brent. So again, I appreciate you joining us, Brent. I think I'll have you. We'll definitely do this again at some other point. Brent was kind enough to submit a plethora of good topics, a lot of them around historical elections in the United States, but I know that's not the only thing that he's capable of being a part of the podcast on, so I know that we'll have him again. And as Brent has already mentioned, the reason that he was here today was because he found us, and that's something that you as a listener can do as well. We certainly encourage you to visit our website. That's at aforkintimepodcast.com. There's an opportunity there to provide feedback. I love the feedback. I don't just need feedback that is reinforcing of what I think. I love when I get challenging comments that come back there. You didn't think about this. How dare you say that? That's exactly what I enjoy, is the discussion that goes back and forth. And so this is not just a monologue, but it becomes a dialogue through those means. And then, of course, the other thing to do there is, I think, as we grow the podcast over time, and I encourage you just to encourage others who you think might be interested. You can share us on Facebook. You can share us on Twitter. Various items of social media that was there that my daughter is not here, but she would tell you because that's what she does in her real life job. The power of social media to spread the podcast. So you can do as Brent has done, and we certainly appreciate that. I want to say thank you personally for that, Brent, for supporting us via Patreon. As Alexis and I have said, we are not in this to make money. If we did, we made a very, very bad choice in terms of doing that. But it is an opportunity through the interactions that we have with our listeners to build a community. And we have a lot of ways to do that. So we encourage you, if you're a listener, particularly if you're a faithful listener, to interact with us and give us topical suggestions. And if you find what's valuable here valuable, and you have some dollars to spare, we certainly would appreciate deferring some of the costs that are there. They're fairly nominal, but they are real. So however you choose to support the podcast, whether that's spreading the word, providing the feedback, providing financial support, as we say all the time, we thank you for that. And we, again, the thing that we value most is the fact that we know you're giving us your time. You could do a lot of other things with your time, even when you're multitasking, other than listening to us talk about alternative history. We think the reason you do that is you find it interesting and find it fascinating, just like we do. And so we appreciate the gift of your time. So, Brent, thanks again for joining me. And I'm going to sign off now for this episode of A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast, and invite you back next week for another episode. Have a great day.
Thanks for listening to A Fork in Time, the Alternate History Podcast. Join us next time.